I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. I'm not sure if Elvis Presley ever stepped foot in Vermont, but as Mojo Nixon once sang, Elvis is everywhere. Vermont does have its share of Elvis impersonators, and now, thanks to filmmaker Eugene Jarecki, who lives in Vermont, there's another connection. Jarecki's new film is called The King, and it follows the road to fame, fortune, and eventually untimely death of Elvis, all in one of the King's cars, a 1963 Rolls-Royce. Eugene Jarecki is an Emmy and Peabody Award-winning documentary filmmaker who has looked at America from many different angles in his films, including The House I Live In, Reagan, and Why We Fight. And he joins us from a studio in Berlin, Germany. Eugene, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me.
Let's listen to a little bit of the trailer for the film to get a taste of The King.
Elvis had was black and it was white. It's all mixed up together.
He was the voice of the country at its best and at its worst.
America is great when America does great things. Well, America's been doing a lot of bad things.
I think that the American dream was always someone's fantasy and someone else's drunken nightmare.
Oh, make us sad, make us sad.
Eugene, let's start by you explaining what we'll see in The King.
Well, it's a cross-country road trip, a musical road trip in Elvis Presley's 1963 Rolls-Royce. So that's what you see and experience. And along the way, we bring all manner of people from the American family into the journey. Famous people like Alec Baldwin and Emmylou Harris and Chuck D and Mike Myers and others. But we also bring everyday people all along the sort of milestones of Elvis's life. We start out in his birthplace in Tupelo, Mississippi, and we travel to Memphis and then Nashville, New York City. Then we cross the country to Hollywood and ultimately Las Vegas. And what we're tracing really is Elvis's own rise and fall in a way, and unpacking the country today as we go. So it's really a portrait of a man and the portrait of the country he left behind.
Why did you choose one of Elvis's cars to road trip to these places?
Well, because Elvis, for me, is inextricable from the American dream. So if we're going to ask questions today about what the state of the American dream is today, what more poetic way could you look at that than through Elvis's own eyes? And I suppose I could have taken, you know, a Cadillac or a Thunderbird or one of these cars that represent the golden age that we think of as kind of the 1950s blue sky America. But I think there's a bit of Kool-Aid in that. And I think there's something much more powerfully poetic about taking the Rolls-Royce. Because what is the Rolls-Royce for Elvis? It's the car that represents, of course, the ultimate success. This country boy has come out of nowhere and he's risen so high that he's become what? A king. And Rolls-Royces are the cars fit for kings. But he became a very lost king. And floating around in the big back seat of that gigantic limousine, looking out the window, I get a very tragic feeling, a very reflective feeling of an Elvis who wonders if it all went in the right direction or not. And that's something that I thought relates very, very strongly to where we feel as a country right now.
I think Emmylou Harris was the one who was even shocked that he once owned a Rolls-Royce, right?
She was, and she goes on to say, you know, that he was really a tragic figure. You know, here's this country boy to whom this thing happened. What was the thing? It was becoming a supernova in popularity around the world. Nobody had ever had that quite before, and Elvis is utterly unprepared for it. You know, I always get the sense when I'm riding around at the back of that Rolls-Royce, whether there are, you know, no matter who's in the car, that I look back and I kind of see Elvis, this young, lost, beautiful country boy, and I get the feeling that he's looking out the window, kind of always looking, if he could, to go back to Tupelo, to where it all started and was so magical in Memphis, Tupelo, and so forth. But the car keeps pressing on, and it presses on toward these destinations that vulgarize and cheapen his life. And it becomes a life in which he's far too overwhelmed by seductions, by power and money, and all that undermined his authenticity.
A lot of people get to ride in the Rolls. How did you choose who got that honor?
Well, you know, the film is full of people, celebrities and non-celebrities, all talking to us in different ways. You know, there were certain people in the film where I knew if you're going to make a film partly about Elvis Presley, you got to have people who knew and loved him and his biographer, Peter Guralnick, or his best friend, Jerry Schilling. But I also knew that you can't make a film about Elvis in the modern era without interviewing Chuck D., who, as the founder of Public Enemy, made the song Fight the Power, in which he sort of cast an aspersion on Elvis as a racist. And that has stuck for many, many people. Millions of African-American people, for example, look at Elvis with some concern about what he represents. So I knew there were Elvis people on all sides of the equation that we had to speak to. But I also knew that in every place along the road trip, there were going to be people that you would just love to talk to in any given place. Everyday people who had been touched by Elvis, or everyday people just living in the Nashville of today, or living in the Detroit of today, living in the LA of today. That sense of where the country is today is every bit as important as anything we learn about Elvis in the film, because the film is not a biopic. It's a film about a man and his country, and how we can learn more about ourselves through this sort of cautionary tale of his own life. And that's where the people who came along the way, they represent sort of a tapestry of the American family that I thought could make a definitive portrait of where things are right now.
Yeah, one of my favorite non-celebrities was you had a group of singers from the Stax Academy in Memphis who piled in the car and sang. You didn't get pulled over for having too many people in the car at that time, did you?
At that particular moment, I thankfully didn't, because they're young people, children Stax Music Academy, learning, you know, gospel music and soul music in the grand tradition of Memphis, in the grand sort of African-American music tradition in Memphis. And it was a wonderful day. And we didn't get pulled over that day. We got pulled over many times and didn't get pulled over that particular day, largely because I would break traffic laws because I'd be in the middle of a music take. After all, I'm driving a mobile recording studio. Yeah. So every time we stop at a traffic light, you know, the sound of the engine changes. It messes up the recording. So I'm like gunning this antique car through questionable yellow lights. I hope there's no police listening. And of course, I never did it in the state of Vermont. But, you know, it was an adventure. And the car broke down at times, as you see in the film. And we took everything on as a metaphor and as something important to the spirit of our story.
Well, right now you're in Germany, so I think you have some diplomatic immunity, so I don't think you're going to be arrested
today. There you go. Yeah, the movie is coming out actually tomorrow night in Germany. As you know, it's playing at the Roxy in Vermont and all over America right now. We love the Roxy, and I love to send people to it there because it's one of my favorite places for people to watch the film. Tomorrow night it comes out nationwide in Germany on German television, so I'm here for that.
Nice. Well, what kind of reactions did you get when you asked people to ride in this Rolls Royce of Elvis's?
Well, you know, whenever you're making a film, if you don't confess to some insecurity about what you're doing, I think you're not taking enough risk to make something special. And so whenever I make films, I'm always wondering, do I have a foolish idea here? And in this film, more than ever, you know, the film stepped up and bought Elvis Presley's Rolls Royce at auction. We knew we had to sell it again when we were done as part of the budget. We knew that meant I couldn't wrap it around a tree or drive it into the, you know, Grand Canyon. So there was a lot of pressure, essentially, on getting it right. So all along the way, you know, I felt as though the risk we were taking was this a good idea? Was it spiritually valid, this metaphoric link? Elvis rose, America rose. Elvis struggled, America struggled, also with premature power, having become the most powerful country in the world at such a young age. Elvis, the king with the world in his hand. And then we watched Elvis' demise, and I thought there was a cautionary tale for America in that. When I saw people enter the car, I started to understand for the first time that my idea wasn't foolish, that I wasn't off on some limb. And I guess it was in the second or third day of shooting, the country rocker John Hyatt enters the car. And I was busy up front, and I had just met him, and I was very honored to meet him. He's an extraordinary musical force. And he sat down in the back of the car all by himself with his guitar. And boy, does he look the part. You know, he just looks the absolute picture of a country rocker. And he got into the back of that car. And I was futzing with something in the front seat. And when I looked up to talk to him, he was crying like a child in the back seat, a grown man where you're usually doing like the sound check for the microphone or the camera check, he's crying his eyes out. And I said, is there something, did somebody do something wrong? Did I say something wrong? He said, not at all. I just feeling the full weight of being in the backseat of this car and feeling what he must have felt. Yep. He, Elvis, trapped in this life, much too big for himself, the soul crushing pressure of it all. And I suddenly understood, I think I'm onto something here. People connect to this car, and they did across the country in very profound ways, very different ways, but a wide range of deeply profound ways.
Yeah, that might have been the most stunning moment of the entire film. Big fan of Hyatt myself, and to see him just break down and to articulate what Elvis must have been feeling through a lot of his life, feeling kind of closed off from people. And we'll talk more about the development of this man's life, which we learn about throughout the film. Were there other special moments that you experienced while filming?
Extraordinary moments. You know, we're there traveling through the country thinking about the American dream. So imagine what it was like for me when I went into into Tupelo, Mississippi, where, of course, there's a tourist center with a house that Elvis was born in, and it's been sort of meticulously maintained. But it's a bit Disney down there. You know, you feel very much, I mean, it's fine. You know, you expect that. So I started poking around, and I learned that, well, he had lived here for a time, but he had then had to move to another part of town when his dad was put in jail in Parchman Penitentiary. And I wanted to find the house he lived in then. And that took some real looking, but we found that in downtown Tupelo, which is really the black part of town, we saw where Elvis and his mother lived in a house in a black area. And that's very much, I think, where some of the formative African-American influences on Elvis's thinking, his spirit, his music, where you really see their chrysalis there. So we go poking around, and nobody in the neighborhood even knows that he lived yeah. there. And then we find one house where we discover the people who live in Elvis's house today, and they talk all about it. And the conversation with them about the American dream is hair-raising. It's almost heartbreaking to hear them think they're sitting in Tupelo, the home of Elvis Presley, where the American dream is in a way sort of born and forged. And these people are basically saying, what American dream? This thing is dead. She actually says Tupelo's gone to hell. Mm-hmm. And when I left the house really shaken by this, I looked back to take one last look at the house, and I was on the way to the vehicles to take off and head to the next place. And what did I notice? I noticed a for sale sign outside the house, which I hadn't seen on the way in. And the for sale sign has a little picture of Elvis Presley on it. And I realized, what has it come to in America where power and money have so run away with our society and trampled over our values that somebody learns that Elvis once lived in their house, and instead of putting up a little plaque, you know, a little copper plaque saying, I'm so proud that Elvis Presley once lived in my house, instead what goes up instantly is a for sale sign. Because after all, you might get a few more $1,000 for the house, and that would be X months of baby formula. Mm-hmm. People are so spread thin in this country, and the race to the top kind of winner-take-all society that is hurting us so terribly, you really feel it in the sort of crushing of our dreams in a place like Tupelo.
Eugene, let's take a call. We have Matt calling from Burlington. Matt, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Eugene, thanks. I use your film Why We Fight in my community college classes a lot. And there's one scene where there was a guy from Iraq keeping track of the deaths in the morgue, and it was, yes. I found it very powerful. I don't know if you could talk more about that.
Sure. I mean, when we were filming Why We Fight, what we were trying to do was do what the American media rarely does, which is to show the other side perspective of a conflict. What they're very proud of showing is how our missiles fire off of our, you know, military aircraft in the sea, or fire from planes and hit warehouses, and they pretend it's all very surgical and clean. Well, it ain't surgical and clean on the ground, and I thought there was no better way to do that than to go into a morgue in Baghdad at the height of the conflict and sit with the morgue director. But the problem with that was that the morgue director could barely keep a straight face as he went through the infant mortalities, the killed civilians, the maimed and destroyed lives. You know, he bursts into tears just talking about something which you would think he's numb to, but it was the farthest thing from that. That's why it's in the film. I was so shaken that even a morgue director, who you would think deals with death every day, even he was unprepared for the kind of wanton destruction that had been unleashed by U.S. forces at that time.
After taking on issues like that and the war on drugs and Ronald Reagan, you know, why Elvis? I mean, did this feel like it was uh, a, I don't know, time off from the more serious subjects or not for you?
Well, my mom has asked me for years when I was going to make a feel-good film. And I did set out to make a feel-good film. And in many ways, I think it is a feel-good film.
It is.
If you love music, if you love a road trip, and if you love thinking with some guarded optimism about the future that America can have and therefore what the world can have. But of course, these are dark times. And the way in which the film looks is quite realistic. And it looks with a very sober eye with what I would call tough love. It looks at Elvis with tough love and it looks at America with tough love. I'm the kind of person who thinks that real love is tough love. I'm not interested in people who just tell me, hey, everything you do is great, nothing you do is wrong. People who've always loved me in a real way have given me an enormous amount of self-esteem and pride and congratulated me for things I've done that are perhaps good. But then they've been brutal with me about my shortcomings, and I've grown from that. And if I could have intervened when Elvis was suffering and when he was being crushed by capitalism, crushed by the power and the money that had become a priority above all else, if I could have intervened like his friends wanted to, Jerry Schilling, George Klein, and others who tried to intervene, I would have desperately tried to intervene and said, where are you going with this? This is not what made you beautiful, not what made you enduring. These B-movies are terrible for you. This Las Vegas deal with the devil is terrible for you. You've got to get free of this. You've got to go to therapy. Well, I have the same go-to-therapy recommendation for America itself, for myself, for all of us who have come to idolize power and money in a way that democracy won't survive. It's unlikely the planet will survive it, but surely, first, democracy won't.
Well, about halfway through your film, there is kind of an intervention. We hear a conversation where you ask your road crew chief, what do you think I'm doing with this movie? And he responds, quite frankly, I don't know what the hell you're doing. And I have to say, Eugene, at that point, I was thinking the same thing. So were you having kind of a crisis of confidence during the film? Did it go away?
If that comes across in the film, it's pretty honest because for sure, you know, I don't pretend to understand the direction of this society or I would say even the misdirection of this society. I'm a pretty good diagnostician. I can see what's going on around me. I can see that the current occupant of the Oval Office is an embodiment of everything that destroyed Elvis Presley. He's the embodiment of everything that will destroy American democracy if we do not stand up and demand the of the people, by the people, for the people country that is promised in those early writings. I know that, and I can feel it in my bones, and as I traveled across the country, it was reconfirmed everywhere. But there's no question that as I went, the 2016 election surprised us. We were making this film before He Who Shall Remain Nameless ran for office. We were making a film literally just about Elvis and the country he left behind. Then all of a sudden, the car got involved, so we made it into a road trip. And then that road trip happened to be timed with an election that was basically tearing the country asunder. So we were driving down a road. It was like an earthquake in a cartoon where the road was opening up before us like a crater. And I was trying to process that country. So when I asked my road crew chief, what do you think I'm doing with this movie? And he said, I don't even think you know what you're doing with this movie. It was fair. I knew what I wanted people to feel, and I knew the kind of conversation I was hoping to promote, and I'm very proud that that is the kind of conversation that people seem to have about the movie. But making it and bringing together the vast musical, philosophical, political, and historical elements into a contemporary road trip with a sense of history, that was a real balancing act. And when I was asking him for help, it just goes to show you I was really looking for help in all directions. He's also a great mentor of mine, so he gives me good advice.
Well, if America is Elvis, how do we come back from the older, fatter Elvis years? Or are we in that dead at 42 on the toilet stage?
I mean, that's the big question of the film. And when the film wraps up, you know, Ethan Hawke gives a speech about how Elvis picked money at every turn and was seduced by money at every turn, and it led to his undoing. And I think, you know, we live in a country where Jeff Bezos of Amazon makes $1.2 million an hour, and Amazon didn't pay any federal tax in 2017. Now, how you could possibly square that with the idea of the people, by the people, for the people, with the idea that we all have the same influence in American life. There's no way to persuade yourself of that. And so where we go from here is really a question of how the movements that we've seen emerge, how they continue to grow and materialize. You know, one of the things about this president is that he certainly didn't mean to, but his repugnant nature as a public person, the vile things that he says publicly about people, and the vile sort of sexist and racist and other overtones and explicit tones in his narrative, they have caused a national outcry, and that has led to the birth of some of the most significant social movements in our lifetime. You know, Me Too, Time's Up, the Parkland students staring down the NRA, the Poor People's Movement, teachers striking in red states where they haven't seen a strike for decades to get better treatment for those who educate our children, and so forth. Everywhere we look, we see woke, as they say, activity. That's truly democratic, and it's beautiful to watch, weirdly, in like the worst of times, but it's very promising, and I am a kind of guarded optimist. I really do look at these very hard facts that we're facing, but I also see an enormous amount of public animation that I haven't seen in my whole lifetime. And I want to be part of that. I think anyone who watches it has to figure out how they can be part of it and not just a spectator.
The King features legendary musicians like Emmylou Harris and Roseanne Cash talking about how Elvis and Elvis's unprecedented level of fame ended up toxic to the actual man behind the music.
There'd never been anyone who became so popular so fast at such an early age.
I think fame is more dangerous than money and power. Elvis, starting out with the sexy wildness in him, you take on the projections of millions of people, and the weight of it can kill you.
Eugene Jarecki, what are your thoughts on celebrity and fame? Does it have to be toxic?
Well, I think it's part of a grave hijacking of what it means to be America. I mean, it's so strange. You know, this is a country that broke off from the King of England, right? Swearing no more kings and queens. Now we find ourselves this many years later. Look at how many Americans watched the royal wedding. Look at how many Americans are glued to the tube to watch The Crown. We have some obsession with royalty, and not just in England. We have an obsession with putting people on a pedestal as if they are more special than we are, as if calling Elvis the king makes him more valuable than a schoolteacher or a firefighter or a dentist. You know, there is something where we have really lost our way. I think if the framers came back and saw this obsession we have with royalty, Mike Myers is in the film, and he marvels as a Canadian about how everything in America is King of Beers, Muffler King, Elvis the king, king-size bed. We are obsessed with this idea of someone becoming the king. Michael Jackson, king of pop. LeBron James, the king. Every time we turn around, we turn toward royalism rather than toward that which made us most beautiful and enduring. And so that's where celebrity is a misunderstanding by us about who we are and are really supposed to be. It's not that Elvis isn't supposed to be popular. It's not that he's not supposed to be successful. But by the time he's a king, lost in the backseat of a Rolls Royce, he is so far from being the country boy that we fell in love with that you can't recognize it. He can't recognize himself anymore. And so we don't want to stop being true to ourselves. We want success within the reasonable parameters of our self-esteem, of a real understanding of who we are. And I think we do that with celebrities at our peril. And then what do we do with those celebrities? We destroy them in turn. We push them so far onto that pedestal that it's inevitable that they're going to fall. And we watch it over and over. And it says an almost self-loathing thing about ourselves, that there's something wrong inside ourselves, that we keep wanting to project a bigger and bigger kind of Wizard of Oz image of ourselves. And then we come out from behind that little curtain and we're just little old us. Well, if we'd never done that projection, it would be great to be little old us. It's just that we've done the projection, and it's deeply misleading.
How much did his lack of a real life during his late teens and early 20s, which is an important part of someone's development, how much did that impact who this guy was?
I mean, Emmylou Harris points that out in the film very poignantly, and it makes him a kind of tragic figure for her because he was unprepared for this. Nobody had gone through this before. There was no role model he could learn from, and he is in those years that are so formative. He loses his mother after he had lost a twin at birth, so he never had the brother he had always kind of wanted and longed for, and he clung very deeply to his mother. He loses his mother. He's sent into the military and drafted as a kind of a public spectacle drafting, but it was real nonetheless. He was stationed stationed in Germany, had never been out of the country before, would never go out of the country again. These are very limited sensibilities that are at work here. And he is a genius in his own way, an amazing artistic genius setting the world on fire, combining black and white influences in his music and his movements and his sensibility that no one had ever done before. But that's raw genius. It's like the raw genius of a, you know, of an extraordinary athlete who can, you know, find their way to the basketball hoop or the end zone or whatever in the footwork. You couldn't possibly predict it. It comes out of some deep and amazing intuitive genius. He has that. But what he doesn't have is savvy. He doesn't have a preparedness for example, what Colonel Parker will do for him and do to him. And so all of that happens a little bit too late. The coins fall a little late in his life, and he only starts to realize it when he's already on a slippery slope he can't come back from.
Well, and part of that slippery slope started in the Army, right?
For sure, where he, you know, was exposed to and became addicted to drugs to keep himself awake on shifts late at night. And I think just in the general loneliness and monotony of military service, the drugs appealed to him at a hard time in his life where he's lost his mother as well. And I think he feels very disoriented, not performing the music that had suddenly made him so popular. And now he's basically quarantined in a foreign country and sort of really is hiding his light under a bushel. So he has his struggles, and those drugs never leave him, and of course they'll ultimately be his undoing. But more than that, they just play a role as self-soothing in a life that runs out of control for Elvis, just as American life has run out of control for us. Americans turn to self-soothing more than any other country on earth, and we do so because we, I think, have some heartbreak in us about who we thought we were going to be compared to who we are. And that's part of the beauty of America, is that we have that promise. A lot of countries don't promise anything. They don't promise an American dream. They don't promise that the sky is the limit or that you can be anything you want to be. That's especially American condition. But it becomes a special American predicament when that promise is broken or falls short. And that's where you find us in such need of self-soothing. And that's what you see in Elvis. And it's such a strong metaphor for the self-soothing that we seek as a population today.
Eugene, let's take another call. We've got Henry calling from Stowe. Henry, go right ahead.
Hi, how are you, Eugene? I was just listening to your segment. First off, I'm calling from an organization that I'm actually interning for called the Borgen Project, and part of what we do is, you know, we work to make international development a focus of American foreign policy as a means to an end of global poverty and hunger. And just going off of your metaphor with Elvis Presley getting sucked into the soothing and how he fell deeper and deeper into a hole, you could say, yes. It kind of seems to really apply to America today in the complacency that we see with right now. For example, we allocate less than 1% of our federal budget to programs that assist the world's poor. And so I was calling, like, let's say with regards to the refugee crisis in Europe and how we see a sort of hysteria, but yet we still see in America that's still kind of focused inward. And I was just wondering what exactly, going back to Elvis Presley, if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, there's a domestic dimension to this and an international dimension. On the domestic dimension, I think America has become a far less kind place in my lifetime. You know, the America I grew up in was the one where you would go to the neighbor's house to get a bowl of sugar. And there was that whole concept of the way in which American community was such a unique force in the world. Europe had become jaded. The Europeans had beaten each other up. There had been tremendous wars. There were tremendous rivalries in between countries. And somehow this United States model had produced a tremendous sense of community that Alexis de Tocqueville saw when he wrote On Democracy. And he saw the town hall structures, for example, in Vermont, and he thought they were so extraordinarily demonstrative of what democracy could be in the strengthening of people. All of that was so magical about America, but boy, does that seem absent in the modern era. So much hatred of one another, so much division, so much violence, one against the other. And this is a domestic feature, and we saw Elvis Presley go from being a young, beautiful child growing up in Tupelo and having the sky be the limit to being a jaded and broken outspoken 42-year-old addicted to all kinds of seductions. One of them was violence, deeply, deeply angry in some way enough that he's firing guns at television screens and at all manner of target and getting that out of his system. And it's not hunting. This is something, you know, far more domestic and frightening for him in his need to break out. And I understand his need to break out, but it has so much in common with that death of community that we see in the country. So at a domestic level, I see a deep parallel in the degrading of Elvis's life with the degrading of American community life. On the international stage, Elvis plays a very different role, which is when Elvis is drafted into the military, just as with every other thing that he is so metaphoric of in the American story, he's a metaphor for the country boy who comes out of nowhere. He's a metaphor for the crossing of black and white music. He's a metaphor for the media business becoming the biggest business in the world, and he's the face of it. He's the poster child for Las Vegas and that strange sort of Faustian bargain with Sin City. But along the way, he becomes the face of the American military empire in the 20th century, when after World War II, enough isn't enough. We then decide to run the world as an empire, and Elvis is the hood ornament on that military machine. And we've been doing it ever since, where we spend more than 93% of our foreign expenditures on the Defense Department and less than 7% on the State Department. And no wonder, therefore, we are so warring. We are so engaged with despotic violence around the world. These are not the American values I was taught to expect when Washington and those around him went up against the standing armies of England. But Elvis is there again. In a toxic way, he's associated with the out-of-control militarism that has come to damage the American Republic so deeply.
I want to ask you about one more really important topic that came up in the film. I mean, he did appropriate the music of African-American artists, but he gets criticized for never offering a hand or standing up for the black community to which he owed so much. So why didn't he ever close that loop?
I would correct you only to say it's dangerous to say that he appropriated black music. There's a debate in the film about that word. And I think Chuck D, who might be the person you would think most would accuse him of that, because Chuck D most famously calls him a racist in the song Fight the Power. Chuck D is very specific. He says, no. I didn't call him a racist because he, quote, appropriated, unquote, black music. I love that he played black music. I think that if a young African-American kid plays Mozart, you wouldn't tell him he shouldn't play it because he's not from Austria. You know, that's culture. Culture is about sharing. We should all play each other's music, eat each other's food, dance each other's dances. That would make a much better world. So when Elvis plays the music of the black community and plays it in his way, that's to be celebrated, just like we celebrate Eminem for being such an extraordinary crossover artist today. Where racism comes and where appropriation comes is from the white music industry that in Chuck D's eyes then gives the credit and the money and the power and the favoritism to an artist like Elvis. He gets to be called the king, as Chuck D says. But what about Bo Diddley? What about Chuck Berry? What about the artists left by the wayside? As Elvis, in his sort of knockoff fashion, it's as if the sequel of a movie got more praise than the original movie. And that violates Chuck D's basic principle of fairness more than any idea that Elvis shouldn't have played it. He should have played it. It's just that the white music industry then stole that music in a way and its full credit from black people. And then there are questions about whether Elvis was there for the black community later on when the black community needed him in the civil rights movement. And I think there's a very justifiable charge by Chuck D and Van Jones in the film, among others, about whether, and Lana Del Rey sings a song in the middle of the film that kind of underscores this, was Elvis there? And her song says, Elvis, where are you when I need you the most? And it's not an accidental lyric for the film. It really is for the black community and for the anti-war community and for those who might have relied on Elvis to keep up the good work of radicalizing America, which he did in the 50s. In the 60s, he's become a more conventional, kind of crew-cutted post-military figure, a bit of a John Wayne who isn't taking issue with the system when we need him the most.
We got about a minute left, but I do want to let people know you did bring Elvis to Vermont. So what are some of the Vermont connections that people will see in the film?
Well, one terrific one is that the absolutely incomparable Cat Wright is in the film, yeah, singing with her lifelong singing partner Maggie Clifford in the group Cat and Maggie, and they do an incredible performance in the film. We also have released a beautiful music video that goes along with the film that people can see online at theking.film, where Ethan Hawke takes Elvis Presley's former girlfriend in high school, takes her to a kind of prom date in the same place where she and Elvis danced the prom, and Ethan Hawke and Dixie Locke, her name is, they dance together while Cat and Maggie sing Bring It On Home to Me, the Sam Cooke favorite, and they do such a beautiful job. Cat's voice and Maggie's voice are their angels in the film, and so that's one very strong Vermont connection. We also filmed a good bit in Vermont. People will see maybe they'll see the Warren Parade. They'll see a lot of kind of beautiful landscapes go by, because my not so secret love for Vermont puts a lot of Vermont imagery in my films, even when people don't realize what they're seeing, because I'm in love with a certain vista, or I'm in love with a road outside of Bristol. We also filmed with the Elvis Presley. He's not even a tribute artist. There is a man in Bristol who's named Elvis Presley, and he lives the life of Elvis Presley, and we went and interviewed him. So everywhere we went. But the most important thing is that Elvis's car, when we first got it, was brought by Peter Markowski in Vergennes of RPM Motors. It was auctioned. He was very helpful. Peter and his family were deeply helpful in getting the car. Then they brought it to Vermont and helped restore the car.
And Eugene, I'm going to have to say goodbye. I appreciate you joining us.
We have 1 second left. I'll just say the engine block is still in Vermont. Elvis's engine block lives in Vermont. Please come to the Roxy and see the movie. We'd love to have you.
All right. Take care, Eugene.
Thanks, everybody.
This is Vermont Edition on VPR.
You.